Chapter 12. Sunday, May 15th to Monday, May 16th. Superintendent Torsten Edklinth, Director of Constitutional Protection at the Security Police, slowly swirled his glass of red wine and listened attentively to the CEO of Milton Security, who had called out of the blue and insisted Edklinth come to Sunday dinner at his place on Lidingö. Armansky's wife, Ritva, had made a delicious casserole. They had eaten well and talked politely about nothing in particular. Edklinth was wondering what was on Armansky's mind. After dinner, Ritva repaired to the sofa to watch TV and left them at the table. Armansky began to tell him the story of Lisbeth Salander. Edklinth and Armansky had known each other for 12 years, ever since a female member of Parliament had received death threats. She'd reported the matter to the head of her party, and Parliament's security detail was informed. In due course, the matter came to the attention of the security police. At that time, personal protection had the smallest budget of any unit. The Member of Parliament was given surveillance during the course of her official appearances, but was left to her own devices at the end of the working day, the time when she was obviously more vulnerable. She began to have doubts about the ability of the security police to protect her. She arrived home late one evening to discover that someone had broken in, daubed sexually explicit epithets on her living room walls, and masturbated in her bed. She immediately hired Milton Security to take over her personal protection. She did not advise Seppo of this decision. The next morning, when she was due to appear at a school in Tebi, there was a confrontation between the government security forces and her Milton bodyguards. At that time, Edklinth was acting deputy chief of personal protection. He instinctively disliked a situation in which private muscle was doing what a government department was supposed to do, but he recognised that the Member of Parliament had reason enough for complaint. Instead of exacerbating the issue, he invited Milton Security's CEO to lunch. They agreed that the situation might be more serious than Seppo had at first assumed, and Edklinth realised that Armansky's people not only had the skills for the job, but also that they were as well trained and probably better equipped. They solved the immediate problem by giving Armansky's people responsibility for bodyguard services while the security police took care of the criminal investigation and paid the bill. The two men discovered that they liked each other a good deal, and they enjoyed working together on a number of assignments in subsequent years. Edklinth had great respect for Armansky, so when he was invited to dinner and to have a private conversation, he was willing to listen. But he had not anticipated Armansky's lobbing a bomb with a sizzling fuse into his lap.
"You're telling me that the security police is involved in flagrant criminal activity?"
"No," Armansky said, "you misunderstand me. I'm saying that some people within the security police are involved in such activity. I don't believe that this activity is sanctioned by the leadership of SIS, or that it has government approval."
Edklinth studied Malm's photographs of a man getting into a car with a registration number that began with the letters KAB.
"Dragon, this isn't a practical joke."
"I wish it were."
The next morning, Edklinth was in his office at police headquarters, meticulously cleaning his glasses. He was a grey-haired man with big ears and a powerful face, but for the moment his expression was more puzzled than powerful. He had spent most of the night worrying about how to deal with the information Armansky had given him. They were not pleasant thoughts. The security police was an institution in Sweden that all parties, well, almost all, agreed had an indispensable value. This led them to distrust the group and at the same time concoct imaginative conspiracy theories about it. The scandals had undoubtedly been many, especially in the leftist radical 70s when a number of constitutional blunders had certainly occurred, but after 5 governmental and roundly criticised Seppo investigations, a new generation of civil servants had come through. They represented a younger school of activists recruited from the financial, weapons and fraud units of the state police. They were officers used to investigating real crimes, not chasing political mirages. The security police had been modernised, and the Constitutional Protection Unit in particular had taken on a new, conspicuous role. Its task, as set out in the government's instructions, was to uncover and prevent threats to the internal security of the nation, that is, unlawful activity that uses violence, threat or coercion for the purpose of altering our form of government, inducing decision-making political entities or authorities to take decisions in a certain direction, or preventing individual citizens from exercising their constitutionally protected rights and liberties. In short, to defend Swedish democracy against real or presumed anti-democratic threats. They were chiefly concerned with the anarchists and the neo-Nazis. The anarchists because they persisted in practicing civil disobedience, the neo-Nazis because they were, by definition, the enemies of democracy. After completing his law degree, Edklint had worked as a prosecutor, and then 21 years ago joined the security police. He had at first worked in the field in the Personal Protection Unit, then within the Constitutional Protection Unit as an analyst and administrator. Eventually, he became director of the agency, the head of the police forces responsible for the defence of Swedish democracy. He considered himself a democrat. The constitution had been established by Parliament, and it was his job to see that it stayed intact.